In the quiet hill country of Texas, a lanky boy with large ears and piercing dark eyes once announced to his astonished classmates, "Someday, I'm going to be President of the United States." This bold declaration from young Lyndon Johnson might have seemed laughable coming from a child in an isolated, impoverished region where most would never escape the cycle of subsistence farming. Yet this statement would prove prophetic. Robert Caro's masterful biography, a favorite of political insiders from Barack Obama to Bill Clinton, has been hailed by the New York Times as powerful and stirring, and by the Washington Post as standing at the summit of American historical writing. Through exhaustive research spanning thousands of interviews and millions of documents, Caro reveals how Johnson's unquenchable ambition, political genius, and complex character transformed American politics and society while exposing the machinery of power itself. The hill country that shaped Lyndon Johnson was a deceptive paradise that lured settlers with its beauty while concealing harsh realities. After trudging across featureless Texas plains, early settlers were captivated by endless rolling hills, ancient oaks, clear springs, and most alluringly, tall grass promising agricultural prosperity. What they couldn't know was that they had crossed an invisible line, the 30-inch rainfall isoheat, marking the minimum rainfall needed for successful farming. The grass had grown over centuries, its roots slowly building a fragile padding atop thin limestone soil. Once disturbed, this delicate ecosystem would collapse. Johnson's family embodied this tragic pattern. His grandfather, Robert Holmes Bunton, had wisely settled just east of this treacherous region, combining idealism with shrewd business acumen to build a prosperous life. The Buntons were tall, striking people with coal-black wavy hair, large ears, and, most distinctively, piercing Bunton eyes set in milky white skin that spit fire and talked. They possessed fierce tempers and strong pride, but also remarkable adaptability. When cattle prices fell, they pivoted to renting grazing land rather than persisting in unprofitable ventures. The Johnson strain, however, lacked this crucial pragmatism. Sam Ely Johnson Jr., Lyndon's father, pushed deeper into the hill country, buying land on credit and dreaming of riches. Initially successful as a state legislator championing populist causes, Sam refused corporate gifts while others profited. He authored the Blue Sky Law, protecting farmers from fraudulent oil schemes, and helped constituents navigate government bureaucracy to secure pensions. But his financial ventures repeatedly failed. By 1922, unable to make payments on his $15,000 mortgage, Sam sold his farm at a loss, still owing $30,000 to banks and merchants. The hill country broke more than Sam's finances, it broke his spirit. Once respected, he became the object of ridicule in Johnson City, with locals quipping he was too smart to work and not smart enough to make a living without working. Young Lyndon absorbed these harsh lessons. As his family's fortunes collapsed, his relationship with his parents changed dramatically. Once idolizing his father, he became defiant and disrespectful. He deliberately provoked his mother by using atrocious table manners and refused his assigned chores. When punished, he would scream so piercingly his cries echoed through Johnson City, though witnesses noted he wasn't actually hurt. This pattern of exaggerated victimhood extended beyond his father. He constantly borrowed food from neighbors while claiming there was nothing to eat at home. Johnson stood out dramatically in Johnson City. His clothing choices veered between extremes, sometimes flamboyantly elegant and other times deliberately shabby. With adults, particularly women, his behavior was most remarkable. He flattered housewives extravagantly, hugged and kissed them, and displayed an uncanny ability to charm them into giving him whatever he wanted. Despite this social boldness, Johnson refused college after high school graduation, devastating his education-loving parents. Instead, he joined other teenagers gravel-topping the highway between Johnson City and Austin, work that was especially difficult for his uncalloused hands. After crashing his father's car, he ran away to California, where his cousin Tom Martin, a prominent attorney, took him in. Johnson's California adventure ended when Martin's drinking binges left the practice in disarray, forcing Johnson to return home after less than a year. In February 1927, after a humiliating beating at a dance in Peters Hall, Johnson finally agreed to attend college. At Southwest Texas State Teachers College in San Marcos, he quickly demonstrated the political acumen that would define his career. Though initially one scared chicken, Johnson displayed remarkable confidence when meeting with Professor Votow for admission, speaking for 40 minutes about his plans and impressing him greatly. Within just 5 weeks, he had maneuvered from the lowly rock squad picking up trash into President Cecil Evans' office as his personal assistant. Johnson's calculated flattery of professors and administrators proved remarkably effective. Despite Evans's fearsome temper, Johnson's excessive obsequiousness won him special privileges and higher wages for campus jobs. While this approach endeared him to faculty, it repelled fellow students. Words won't come to describe how Lyndon acted toward the faculty, how kowtowing he was, how suck-assing he was, how brown-nosing he was, recalled classmate Milton Kennedy. Johnson's aggressive food grabbing at the boarding house and his conversation-dominating personality further alienated peers. Most astonishing to his classmates was Johnson's complete indifference to truth. Fellow students began asking him questions just to laugh at his answers. When caught in lies, Johnson showed no embarrassment. He just didn't care. This trait earned him the nickname Bull Johnson, with students defining Bull as Greek philosophy in which Lyndon Johnson has an MB degree. Johnson's political awakening came through the formation of the White Stars, a rival group to the elite Black Stars athletic fraternity that controlled campus politics. Though initially not welcome in this new organization, Johnson immediately saw its political potential. He suggested running a White Star candidate for senior class president and displayed remarkable tactical skill, carefully counting potential votes and identifying untapped voting blocks, the townies, YMCA members, and campus non-entities who belong to no crowd. Johnson realized these outs collectively outnumbered the ins and could win an election if properly organized. His political genius emerged in his first campus campaign. He chose Bill Deason as candidate rather than himself. "I've made too many enemies," recognizing that Deason's good looks would appeal to the female-dominated student body. Johnson invented the "brains are just as important as brawn" platform to redirect student activity funds from athletics to debate and drama, an issue crafted to appeal to his targeted voting blocks. His campaigning style was relentless, and when the White Stars were ready to concede defeat on election eve, Johnson worked through the night to flip 20 crucial YMCA votes, securing Deason's unexpected victory. Johnson's political ruthlessness extended beyond procedural manipulation. He cultivated female voters through strategic dating, exploiting the school's gender imbalance, where women outnumbered men 3-1. His political genius lay in his secrecy. Despite his lifelong tendency to boast about everything else, he maintained absolute silence about his political machinations. The White Stars operated under strict secrecy rules Johnson devised. No three members could be seen talking together, meetings moved to the Hofheinz Hotel away from prying eyes, and members could technically deny membership when directly questioned. After graduation, Johnson briefly taught in Cotulla, Texas, a desolate town 60 miles from the Mexican border. Unlike the five local housewives who taught at Wellhausen School with minimal effort, Johnson transformed the school. As principal, he ordered teachers to supervise recess, secured volleyball and softball equipment, and arranged interscholastic activities despite the school board's refusal to provide transportation. He enforced strict discipline, spanking boys and tongue-lashing girls who misbehaved. Believing their greatest handicap was limited English proficiency, he banned Spanish on school grounds. Johnson tirelessly taught his Mexican-American students American values, repeatedly telling them that anyone could become president who was willing to work hard enough. Johnson's political breakthrough came in December 1931 when he became secretary to newly elected Congressman Richard Clayburgh. Despite living in a shabby hotel basement room with exposed pipes, Johnson would run eagerly each morning toward the magnificent marble capital. His boss, Clayburgh, the wealthy heir to 20% of the massive King Ranch empire, was a playboy who preferred rodeos, poker, drinking, and playing accordion to governance. He blamed the Depression on Al Capone and Prohibition, and had only run as a favor to lobbyist Roy Miller. After winning easily, Clayburgh spent mornings sleeping off hangovers and afternoons golfing, leaving his office and the 14th District's business entirely to his eager young secretary. Johnson attacked his job with frenzied energy. Estelle Harbin would arrive before 8 a.m. to find Johnson's office already lit and him writing letters. Unable to dictate effectively, he'd draft and redraft correspondence for her to type. When the mail arrived, they'd sort it together before Johnson hit the phones. He had charm to burn, Harbin recalled, developing a real pipeline to all the bureaus and pursuing constituent matters like it was life and death. Each success thrilled him. He'd put down the phone, "Stell, yay!" He'd just practically jump up and down. Johnson soon brought his former debate students Gene Latimer and L.E. Jones to Washington. Latimer came for love, to be near his fiancée and earn enough to marry. Jones came for ambition, desperate to escape his impoverished Houston background. Johnson secured them jobs at bargain rates, keeping most of the district's clerk hire allowance for himself. In return, Johnson extracted extraordinary labor. Latimer worked the 5 a.m. to noon mail shift, then reported immediately to room 258 until as late as midnight. Johnson even had him squeeze in office work between mail deliveries. "Our job was to keep those typewriters humming," Latimer recalled. Johnson would manipulate their competitive instincts. "Gene, it seems L.E.'s a little faster than you today," spurring them to pound for hours without stopping, just as fast as we could. The Great Depression created unprecedented suffering across America. By 1932, farm mortgage debt had ballooned from $3 billion to $10 billion, with one in eight farms facing foreclosure. Relief bills were delayed for months by squabbling over minor details, resulting in an average stipend of just 50 cents per day for a family of four. President Hoover remained stubbornly resistant to direct relief, insisting the nation couldn't squander resources while dining lavishly as Americans suffered. When Roosevelt took office in March 1933, he immediately confronted the banking crisis with confident resolve. Then, just 12 days after taking office, Roosevelt turned to the farm crisis that had been worsening for decades. His five-paragraph message to Congress contained words farmers had waited generations to hear, that their problems were of equal importance to those of banks. In just 69 days, Roosevelt had delivered what farmers had been requesting for decades. Johnson seized this opportunity to demonstrate his exceptional abilities. With Congressman Clayburgh spending his time at Burning Tree Golf Course and dismissing the AAA as socialistic and radical, Johnson navigated the bureaucratic labyrinth himself. He cultivated relationships with everyone from top officials to secretaries, anticipating their thoughts and winning their cooperation. When farmers hesitated to sign up for the new programs due to confusion and distrust, Johnson personally educated his district, calling county agents and influential farmers. While the national cotton sign-up program progressed so slowly that Secretary Wallace threatened cancellation, the 14th District had already exceeded its quota. Johnson devised an innovative plan to save 67 South Texas farms from foreclosure. He proposed farmers offer mortgage companies a third of their yet unplanted 1934 crop in exchange for a year's extension, while convincing the Federal Land Bank to consider soil productivity in loan calculations, providing farmers enough money to pay arrears. Johnson arranged a crucial meeting between desperate farmers and credit officials at Clayburgh's Gulf Front home. His plan succeeded. The government promised faster, more liberal refinancing. Mortgage holders agreed to remove foreclosure notices, and within a week, all 67 farms were appraised and refinanced. In April 1933, Johnson engineered a political coup by becoming Speaker of the Little Congress, a once moribund organization for congressional secretaries. Using tactics reminiscent of his college politics days, Johnson secretly mobilized new secretaries, mailmen, and elevator operators to overwhelm the established succession process. Once in power, Johnson transformed the social club into a political organization serving his ambitions. He instituted weekly meetings featuring prominent speakers like Huey Long, attracting media attention with newsreel cameras and reporters. In 1934, Johnson began courting Claudia Alta Ladybird Taylor of Karnak, Texas, and like his previous romantic interests, she was the daughter of the richest man in town. Thomas Jefferson Taylor had built an empire in East Texas through general stores, cotton gins, and money lending. By the time he married, he owned 18,000 acres and lived in the impressive brick house outside Karnak. Ladybird was born in 1912, and when she was five, her mother died, leaving her deeply lonely. She was shy and socially awkward, describing herself as coming from a lonesome place. At school, she was academically brilliant, but socially insecure. At the University of Texas, she remained reserved, dressing plainly despite her father's unlimited charge account. When she met Lyndon Johnson in September 1934, he immediately showered her with questions, then asked her to marry him on their first date. Despite finding him excessively thin, she was drawn to his charisma in a moth and flame attraction. Johnson pursued her relentlessly with letters asking, "Why must we wait?" and promising to show her every interesting place in the world. They married in November 1934 after a brief courtship. From the beginning, Johnson dominated the relationship, often embarrassing her by ordering her around in public. She adapted quickly to his demands, saying, "He early announced that he didn't intend to do any errands or any housework, and I execute what he wants." Despite never having swept a floor, she learned to manage their household and became known for her graciousness. Most significantly, her graciousness attracted Sam Rayburn, who began visiting every Sunday for breakfast, a crucial relationship for Johnson's career. Rayburn was a man who never forgot his roots. Born in 1882 as the eighth of 11 children on a poor Tennessee farm, his childhood was defined by grueling farm labor. "I plowed and hoed from sun till sun," Rayburn recalled, dismissing romantic notions about farm life. This hardscrabble upbringing shaped Rayburn's fierce political views. He despised the railroads that charged exorbitant freight rates, the banks that exploited farmers with high interest, and utility companies that refused to extend power lines to rural areas. The defining moment of Rayburn's childhood came when he was 12 and traveled 11 miles through pouring rain to hear Congressman Joseph Weldon Bailey speak. Too intimidated by the rich town folks in their store-bought clothes to enter the tabernacle, he peeked through a canvas flap, transfixed for 2 hours as Bailey delivered his speech. From that day forward, Rayburn knew exactly what he wanted: to serve in the state legislature for 3 terms, become speaker, then win election to Congress by age 30, and eventually become Speaker of the U.S. House. Johnson's greatest impact came in bringing electricity to the rural hill country where he was born. While electricity had been integral to urban American life for generations, it remained absent from the hill country. Texas Power and Light had electrified only a handful of towns with unreliable 30-horsepower diesel engines that operated dark to midnight with flickering 10-watt bulbs and at rates too high for most families. The absence of electricity forced hill country farmers to milk cows by hand before dawn using dim kerosene lanterns or in complete darkness to avoid fire risks. Without refrigeration, milk spoiled quickly despite expensive ice hauled from town. But as difficult as the farmer's life was, his wife's was even harder. Without electricity or windmills, which at $400 were unaffordable, water had to be carried from distant streams or lifted by bucket from wells 50 to 100 feet deep. Farm families needed 200 gallons, 4/5 of a ton of water daily, requiring 63 8-hour days annually to haul it from wells averaging 253 feet from houses. The physical toll was permanent. "You see how round-shouldered I am? Well, that's from hauling the water," explained many hill country wives, their backs bent well before my time. Every Monday, without fail, came wash day, an exhausting ritual performed outside with 3 zinc wash tubs and a dishpan. Women scrubbed clothes on washboards with homemade lye soap, then punched them in boiling water with broomsticks, mimicking the agitator of an electric washing machine. Each garment required multiple rinsings and wringing by hand. "By the time you got done washing, your back was broke," said Ava Cox. "I'll tell you, of the things of my life that I will never forget how much my back hurt on wash days." Ironing was a grueling task that required multiple 6 or 7 pound solid irons that needed constant reheating on wood stoves. Most women couldn't afford the $2 wooden handles, so they used potholders to protect their hands. The worst aspect was the heat. Women had to maintain blazing fires in their stoves all day, even during summer when temperatures outside might reach 100 degrees. Hill country women called these instruments sad irons for good reason. By 1935, electricity remained unavailable to the vast majority of American farmers. More than 6 million of the country's 6.8 million farms had no power. For decades, farmers across America had begged utility companies to extend power lines to their farms, often pleading in desperation when illness struck their families. The utilities consistently refused, claiming costs were prohibitive, $5,000 per mile, and that farmers wouldn't use enough electricity to justify the expense. When the Rural Electrification Administration was created in 1935, the Hill Country's hopes for electricity were initially dashed by minimum population requirements. The REA Act mandated self-liquidating loans with a minimum of 3 farms per mile of electrical line. The Hill Country, with its sparse population spread across rugged terrain, simply couldn't meet this threshold. When representatives from 5 counties tried to form the Pedernales Electric Cooperative, an REA representative bluntly told them, "You have too much land and not enough people." Everything changed when Lyndon Johnson entered the picture. Meeting with rancher E. Babe Smith behind a drugstore counter, Johnson made a bold promise about bringing electricity to the dark corner of Burnett County. "I'll get it for you. I'll go to the REA. I'll go to the president if I have to." When all else failed, Johnson went straight to the top. After unsuccessful attempts with the REA administrator, Johnson asked Tommy Corcoran to arrange a meeting with President Roosevelt. Though Johnson told varying accounts of this meeting in later years, the result was clear. On September 27, 1938, the PEC received a telegram announcing an REA loan of $1,322,000, later increased to $1,800,000, to build 1,830 miles of electric lines serving 2,892 Hill Country families. When Morris Shepherd, Texas's senior senator, died suddenly of a stroke on April 9, 1941, Lyndon Johnson immediately began plotting his campaign for the vacant seat. Working with Alvin Wirtz, Johnson faced a significant challenge. Outside his congressional district, most Texas voters had never heard of him. A poll showed only 5% of voters favored Johnson, compared to 33% for Governor W. Leo Daniel, 26% for Attorney General Gerald Mann, and 9% for Congressman Martin Dies. Johnson's strategy mirrored his successful 1937 campaign, linking himself to Roosevelt, whose popularity in Texas remained strong. Though Roosevelt officially maintained neutrality in Democratic primaries, he orchestrated a scenario that implied endorsement, having Johnson meet with him just before a press conference. Johnson announced his candidacy from the White House steps, saying he would campaign under the banner of Roosevelt. His campaign emblem featured the picture of Roosevelt and Johnson shaking hands at their first meeting in Galveston 4 years earlier, with Governor Allred airbrushed out. Johnson's Senate campaign organization resembled his 1937 House campaign, but on a larger scale. Alvin Wirt directed strategy from his Interior Department desk, while John Connolly ran campaign headquarters in Austin. The organization consisted primarily of loyal National Youth Administration workers who had proven their dedication and competence under Johnson's leadership. Money had eliminated two strong potential candidates before the race began. Congressman Wright Patman admitted, "I wanted to run, but I couldn't afford to run. Lyndon can be financed." Johnson, however, had ample funding from diverse sources. New Deal supporters contributed through Tommy Corcoran. New York money flowed from both labor sources and Wall Street corporations. Justice William O. Douglas regularly called fundraisers Elliot Yanaway asking, "How are you doing for Lyndon?" With unprecedented funding, Johnson could hire the best talent money could buy. Top political reporters left their newspapers to write press releases under Herb Henderson's direction. Legendary PR wizard Phil Fox of Dallas was retained for $300 weekly. Johnson influenced editorial policy at hundreds of weekly newspapers through strategic ad placements, offering $25 weekly ads to papers with sound views. The campaign scale was staggering. 82 professional secretaries worked from the Stephen F. Austin Hotel mezzanine, addressing thousands of personalized letters, supplemented by students from an Austin secretarial school addressing 7,000 envelopes weekly. Johnson saturated media with his Roosevelt connection, running expensive ads in 60 daily newspapers and hundreds of weeklies. Everything changed when a 29th candidate entered the race, Governor W. Lee O'Daniel. Until his gubernatorial run 3 years earlier, O'Daniel had never participated in politics, not even as a voter. He had been a flower salesman and radio announcer who transformed himself into Pappy O'Daniel, beloved radio personality whose light crust doughboys and later hillbilly boys played country music while he delivered homespun wisdom, religious messages, and sentimental tributes to mothers, Texas, and traditional values. When Johnson learned O'Daniel was entering the race, the shock devastated him. He took to his bed for almost 2 weeks with what aides called nervous exhaustion and Lady Bird described as depression. He insisted his hospitalization at Scott and White Clinic be kept secret, throwing a fit when aides suggested otherwise. Johnson emerged on May 26th much thinner, his demeanor transformed from arrogant to humble. But he came out fighting with ruthless pragmatism. He threatened communities with withholding federal grants and loans if they didn't support him, telling rural leaders they'd only get electricity if their ballot boxes showed Johnson votes. To keep dwindling crowds engaged, Johnson introduced a startling innovation, giving away money at rallies disguised as defense bonds and stamps. Every attendee received a ticket for drawings held after Johnson's speech, with prizes ranging from $25 in rural areas to $175 in cities. Johnson's Keep Pappy in Texas strategy proved devastatingly effective. After just 1 week back campaigning, he confidently incorporated the argument into statewide radio addresses, pointing out that Texas pension checks averaged only $9.50 instead of a possible $40 because the state contributed just $4.75 against the federal government's matching $20. Election day began promisingly, with early returns showing Johnson ahead of O'Daniel by a widening margin. After voting in Johnson City and kissing mothers and grandmothers as he had as a teenager, Johnson arrived at the Stephen F. Austin Hotel, took a sleeping pill, and napped while his mother guarded the door. Upon waking, he made a critical error. When South Texas bosses called asking when to report their county's votes, Johnson instructed them to report immediately. The Valley returns were overwhelmingly lopsided. Duval County, which had given O'Daniel 95% just a year before, now gave Johnson 95% and O'Daniel just 5%. By 9:30 that evening, Johnson led by more than 13,000 votes and was hoisted on supporters' shoulders in wild celebration. With 96% of votes counted, newspapers declared him the winner. Johnson's premature reporting of his South Texas strongholds proved disastrous. By reporting early, Johnson revealed exactly how many votes O'Daniel would need to overtake him. As Monday's late returns arrived, Johnson's lead evaporated through suspicious vote patterns. East Texas counties that had previously favored Dyes now showed dramatic shifts to O'Daniel. Johnson tried countering by seeking additional votes from George Parr, who refused. "Lyndon, I've been to the federal penitentiary, and I'm not going back for you." By Tuesday, O'Daniel had pulled ahead by more than 1,000 votes. The final official count gave O'Daniel 175,590 votes to Johnson's 174,279. Johnson had lost due to a political fluke. O'Daniel's foes wanted him out of the governor's office, not necessarily in the Senate. But it was Johnson's mistake that enabled them to steal his victory. He had worked meticulously for 10 years, relaxed for one day, and lost. Johnson's defeat in the Senate race marked a temporary setback in his meteoric rise. Yet the foundations he had built, his relationship with Roosevelt, his mastery of New Deal programs, his network of loyal supporters, and his access to Texas oil money would ultimately propel him to unprecedented heights of power. The young man who had once declared he would be president had laid the groundwork for a political career that would reshape America. Robert Caro's masterful biography reveals not just the story of one ambitious politician, but the machinery of power itself, how it is acquired, how it is wielded, and how it transforms both those who possess it and the society it governs. Through Johnson's rise, we witness the modernization of rural America, the expansion of presidential authority, and the complex interplay between personal ambition and public service. The hill country boy who once stood in a cotton field dreaming of escape would go on to become one of the most consequential presidents in American history, passing landmark civil rights legislation while simultaneously escalating the Vietnam War. His story, as Caro tells it, is fundamentally American, a tale of remarkable achievement alongside a naked hunger for power, so fierce and consuming that no consideration of morality or ethics, no cost to himself or to anyone else, could stand before it.